Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Two of our guests from last year keep a return engagement with us this hour. Manhattan, WGN America's award-winning drama, just launched season 2. Creator executive producer Sam Shaw will join us salute to the series tonight as part of the New York Television Festival's opening festivity. And he rejoins me next. Diversity on television has taken big leaps since Native President Eglon Simons was here last fall. We'll hear his ideas on where diversity goes beyond this fall at the bottom of the hour. Also upcoming, our classic trivia question of the week. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Thank you all for starting your Monday and your week with us here on Blog Talk Radio. 51 degrees at the top of the hour, and this is the program all about television. We have two of our favorite guests from last year back with us this hour, as we said at the top, and we invite you, as always, to be part of the program. It's so easy to be part. Just give us a ring. Here's the number you use. If you have a question or comment for either of our guests today, it's 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio. And if getting a phone call is not your style, chat room is better, do it. Do our chat room, SimonApple04 by name, and be involved. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on that Facebook icon somewhere on the Blog Talk screen. Follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. And now live with us, the creator executive producer of the Emmy Award-winning Manhattan, now in season 2, Tuesday nights at 9 on WGN America. He's in town for the New York Television Festival. We welcome back Sam Shaw. Sam, great to have you back.
Hey, Simon. It's great to talk to you again.
So how do you like the fact that you're starting season 2 with a public showcase like this?
Well, it's really exciting. Look, We make the show. We're so enormously proud of it, but we sort of make it in hermetic isolation, you know, out in New Mexico. It's sort of almost akin to what these physicists did when they built the atomic bomb. And so it's a really unusual thing for us and an exciting thing to be able to watch an episode live with an audience of fans of the show. And it's great to be able to get back together with our incredible cast.
Yeah, talk about that cast. How do they feel about coming to the Big Apple and seeing their work on the screen?
Well, you know, I have not seen them yet. Rumor has it they're staying in this very hotel somewhere around. So I look forward to seeing them all. Look, we have an extraordinary, extraordinary group of performers on the show. I say this humbly because I'm blowing someone else's horn, but I think we have, the finest ensemble of actors on television right now. And so it's such a gift to be able to work with them, and it'll be a lot of fun to see them.
What are you most proud of, Sam, with season 1? You come on with your creation. You come on a television network that just really started last year to get into original television, first with Salem, then your program. And here you are a year later. You get an Emmy Award. We'll talk about the Emmy. It's a very unique Emmy Award. But for a first-time show, that's a big deal. And also, WGN is really coming together in terms of doing more originals.
Yeah, look, the creative team at WGN has been so supportive of our show, and it's been a joy for us to call WGN America our home. But in terms of what we're most proud of, I'll tell you, I think it's this. We're making a show that is seemingly about some material that could be perceived as abstruse or hard to connect with. You know, it involves nuclear physics, these physicists who are building the most devastating weapon that humankind has ever known. And it is set in the 1940s, a time period that people, you know, may not connect with emotionally when they first hear that that's what a show is about. What I'm proudest of is I think it is a show that really resonates and says something about the contemporary moment. And I think it's a show that when people discover it for themselves, really holds a mirror up to the present day. And you know, the thing that people tell me is that they're really surprised, besides the fact that they're surprised that that they laugh or that they find thrilling, a show that involves nuclear physics and science, as well as, you know, spycraft and intrigue. It's exciting to me that people perceive it as a show that has something to say about the world we're living in right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think people got that connection, especially with such an event like what happened in Los Alamos in the 40s and 50s? How do you make, as a writer, working with director Thomas Schlamm, working with the cast, how do you set up that connection so that we understand it when we watch it?
Well, here's part of it to me. you know, I think we live in a world right now that feels uncertain and dangerous. You know, we've lived in that world really since 9/11. It feels very precarious. And that's something we all feel viscerally. I think it's one of the reasons why there are so many, you know, a sort of joke that America never met an apocalypse that didn't like. You know, we love zombie stories. We love to see cities destroyed. And part of it is that, you know, it says something about our psyche in a sense of the world as an uncertain place. You know, this story fundamentally is a story about a group of people who got together and for the first time developed a weapon, by the way, for the most noble purposes conceivable, which was to end this horrific war, and these physicists believed to rid the world of war forever. But they got together and they invented a weapon that had the capability of wiping all human life off the face of the earth, prospectively. And, you know, it opens up a huge set of emotional questions about, you know, how you live your life in a world that feels precarious and dangerous. And I think that that's, a sort of emotional state that really speaks to our condition in 2015.
Well, speaking with Sam Shaw, he is in town as the creator and executive producer of WGN America's Manhattan because the New York Television Festival opens tonight, and his program is the subject of one of the opening night events. And we'll tell you how you can get in that opening night event a little bit later on. There are still, I believe, tickets available from what I understand. And Manhattan just launched its second season. It's on Tuesday night at 9 Eastern, 8 Central on WGN America. Sam is with us live, as we said, from New York this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Applebaum live with you also from New York here on Blog Talk Radio this Monday afternoon. Happy you are board, even happier if you get involved with the program. So give us a ring at 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 my name. You're welcome to get 669 and 676 into the program. Another one of the top new talents hitting TV's theme this year will join us on Friday's episode. He's John J. Demme. He's the co-creator and executive producer of Amazon's new critically acclaimed series, Red Oaks, with Steven Soderbergh as one of the other executive producers. John J. Demme, he's live, and he's our first guest next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. And next Monday, we're going to arrive to Cape Town, South Africa, where we will meet the producer of that country's popular morning show. It's called Expresso. Think of it as a mix of Good Morning America, Today, and CBS This Morning, All Roads One. The better thing is, you can now see it where you are in these United States by way of the Africa Channel on a same-day presentation. We'll speak with Bradley Vandenberg live from Cape Town, South Africa, a week from today, right here, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. So, Sam, how do you build everything you did in Season 1 into Season 2? Where does the story pick up?
Well, you know, viewers of our show will remember that we sort of we took great pride in burning a lot of furniture at the end of last season. We sort of upended every story structure that we'd spent an entire season building, which was not an act of demolition or masochism on our part. It was actually it was tremendously exciting for us to challenge ourselves with rebuilding the story in a kind of exciting and high stakes new climate for our characters. So our protagonist disappears at the end of our first season. Charlie Isaacs, a young physicist, is sort of elevated to the center of the Manhattan Project. And I think viewers who came to the first episode or who catch up with it now will find that our season does a lot of really provocative and interesting things with time. So we, in some ways, pick up immediately afterward and reveal some of the events that take place after our season finale. And then there are some events that take place, you know, dramatically far into the future as we are getting ready to deploy this kind of awesome weapon of mass destruction that has been developed at Los Alamos.
Mm-hmm. And how do things take off from there? I know you don't want to give too much away, But what are the things we can expect, at least in the early episodes?
Well, here's what I will say. You know, last season, in a way, our characters who arrived at this place, kind of a cultural desert island, this mysterious city built in the desert overnight by the U.S. Army to develop this secret weapon, they were for the most part, new arrivals. And this weapon they were building was still kind of an abstract idea. You know, they were scientists, physicists, chemists, and they were kind of working on an intellectual problem to be solved. This season drives us kind of inexorably toward the moment when that weapon ceases to be a bunch of numbers on a blackboard and instead becomes a weapon of mass destruction that is going to be deployed. And all of these physicists and their families in this secret city are forced to really reckon with the reality of this thing that they've developed and what it is, no longer in a way to be scientists, but to be combatants of a kind, or even, you know, in certain cases, casualties of war. So I think it is the pace is much more headlong this season, and there's a kind of moral thriller that runs its course through these 10 episodes.
Mad Men, of course, had John Hamm as its lead, who became a sensation through that program. You have someone who is a John, whose name is John Benjamin Hinckley, and a lot of people thought he might have been able to get an Emmy Award nomination. A lot of critics were very impressed with his character.
Well, John is absolutely extraordinary. You know, our entire cast, the bench is so deep, and the caliber of these actors is so extraordinarily high. But John is a wonder. You know, he won the Tony Award for Best Actor for The Normal Heart, a few years ago, and he has that kind of ethic and the kind of depth that great theater actors have. And I will say that the episode that we are screening tonight at the New York TV Festival, and which is going to air tomorrow night on WGN America, our second episode of the season, it is an incredible showcase of John's depth and versatility as an actor. I will say, I think it's the finest piece of TV acting that you're likely to see this year.
Mm-hmm. As a creator and an executive producer, you're in the position of serving two very unique corporate masters. One is Lionsgate, probably the most opportunistic television production company around, who, of course, they did Mad Men and so much more, and Skydance Television, which was their first television series. We had Marcy Ross, the key television person there, who also does a show called Grace and Frankie that is on Netflix. That's coming back for its second season next year, the pairing of Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. And, of course, Tomlin was up for an Emmy Award for Best Actress in a comedy this year. What was it like to deal with those two companies, both of whom really have some very unique agendas when it comes to television making?
Well, I will tell you, it may make your head spin, but it's even slightly more complicated because, our network is WGN America, and they have their own studio arm, which is Tribune Studios. And Tribune Studios is also kind of part of this tripartite studio that finances our show. So it's true that there are, or at least on paper, it sounds as if there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And what I will say is that in their own way, they've all been tremendous partners to us. It's been a really wonderful experience. And I say that as someone who knows that it's not always a wonderful experience. But, Lionsgate, I think that Kevin Beggs and Sondra Stern and Chris Selleck at Lionsgate, have such exquisite taste. At Skydance, Marcy and David Ellison, Dana Goldberg, and, as a company, are kind of best known for these big tentpole, experiential, immersive movies, the Mission Impossible movies, for example. But they really believed in and loved this story. So it's been a great asset to have them as a kind of creative backer because I think everyone has had a vested interest in making this show the best version of itself that it can be. And I'm enormously proud of the place we've landed in this second season. I think it's even stronger than our first.
What makes the experience wonderful, Sam? Is it that what actually happens matches your ideals or your expectations for your creation, or going beyond it, or along the way maybe taking you a different direction you didn't expect and it turns out a lot to your liking?
Well, the latter, in a way. Tommy Schlamme, my partner in crime, who's an executive producer and, the brilliant and prolific TV director who's probably best known for his work with Aaron Sorkin on The West Wing and Sports Night. Tommy likes to talk about this notion of writer's Darwinism in television, which is sort of a way of saying that you kind of go in with best laid plans, but the show evolves. The show teaches you what the show is. And, of course, that happens when you're writing for actors. I came to this project with a really strong sense of who these characters are. But once there are these, incredible artists who are bringing the words to life, you'd be an idiot if you didn't listen to what they have to tell you about who the characters are. And often you have the sense that the story has its own kind of its own intentions. And look, it's starts to sound a little new agey, as if, you know, you're sort of sitting with a crystal waiting for some, you know, phantom to whisper in your ear what's going to happen on the next page. And unfortunately, for me at least, the writing process is a lot more grueling than that. But the greatest pleasure in it, I will say, is making the show with so many tremendously talented people, each of whom is, in his or her own way, a co-creator of the show. And so in the end, I think it really, it's something that is more alive and more surprising than it ever would have been if I had just made it myself in some monk's cell somewhere.
The next episode of Manhattan Season 2 is tomorrow night on WGN America. It's 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific time, 8 p.m., excuse me, Central time. We're speaking with Sam Shaw. He's the creator and executive producer of the series, now in Season 2, and getting a major showcase tonight as part of opening night of the New York Television Festival. And I believe there are tickets still available for that presentation, and if you want to see if they are available, here's where you go online. It's www.nytvf.com. That's www.nytvf.com. And throughout the week, there'll be all sorts of special events, but there'll also be about 50 television pilots by independent producers currently outside the TV system that want to be in the TV system. And they'll be showcased all throughout the week at various places, including the School of Visual Arts Theater on 23rd Street and 8th Avenue in Manhattan, as well as the Herald Mills Theater on 26th Street between 5th and 6th, also in Tribeca. And it all wraps up on next Saturday night. Sam is with us this half hour on Tomorrow We Tell Lies. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. Happy you are aboard. If you have a question or comment, get it in. The number you use, 646-652-2906. Or use that chat room, SimonApple049, get 669 and 676 in the room. In addition to Tomorrow We Tell Lies on radio, if you're in the New York area, you can catch BK Live. It is B-Rick TV's weekday noontime variety show. And I was on there earlier today with two of the contenders in the New York Television Festival. They're Michael Borman and Lucas Stein. They're the co-creators, co-writers, and even co-actors of a program that they taped in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, in their apartment park called Dead John. That pilot will be screening at the festival starting on Thursday. If you want to catch that episode, you can check it out either later today or first thing tomorrow at www.youtube.com/BRICKTV. That's www.youtube.com/BRICKTV. And if you're in the New York area, you can catch BRICK Live and BK Live. It's from noon to 1 o'clock on BRICK TV. It's available throughout New York City on Verizon Fios, throughout Brooklyn on Time Warner Cable, Cablevision Systems, and RCN. Well, Sam, your program won a very unique Emmy Award a few weeks back, and it was for outstanding title design. It's by a wonderful company called Imaginary Forces, the folks behind the Spider-Man titles from Sam Raimi, behind Mad Men. Anything you see from them, it's usually very, very well done. Did you have a hand in shaping that title?
You know, I first of all, I'm a huge I'm a title design nerd. I love titles. You know, I from Saul Bass onward. And it's funny, you know, this is a time when a lot of shows are abandoning titles. I think particularly on a show like ours, a title sequence has a really important function, which is to help contextualize what you're going to see. And so I did. I had a really strong set of opinions about what our titles should look like, and we talked to a bunch of incredibly talented people at a bunch of talented companies. And in the end, Imaginary Forces brought a set of ideas that was so unlike anything that anyone else had brought. People who are familiar with our titles know that in a way they tell a story that doesn't seem to be steeped in just a kind of history of the Manhattan Project or the atomic bomb. It really is a story about the birth of the atomic age. And it's a story, I think, that hints at what the scope and ambitions of our show are, which are not really a show about World War II, but much more about this atomic America that was, born in the aftermath of the bombs that dropped in Japan.
Mm-hmm. And then the title, which lasts about 40, 45 seconds, in addition to getting, of course, the cast names and your name and so on, and, of course, the name of the show. There's a lot of interesting charts, and it's like draft sketches of a town growing up, Los Alamos growing up. And you have these like minute people who are all gathering around like a center circle, if you will. And I think one of the fun things about seeing that title is how that kind of imagery really takes the story, and you're just like, in 45 seconds, you get it, whether you've seen the show or not.
Well, yeah, I think they did an extraordinary thing. There's great wit to it as well, I think. It seems to to gesture toward or wink at a lot of kind of iconic pieces of design from television and from cinematic history. Those little figures with their shadows, to me, always evoke the conversation and really an opening of the conversation, which has always been one of my favorite movies, and says something about the surveillance state, which is, you know, one of the aspects of this show. We're sort of interested in secrecy and surveillance. You know, there are a lot of allusions. There's a lot of wit, the sort of juxtaposition of recipes with, you know, with pages of math that sort of outlines the making of an atomic bomb. That kind of brilliant kernel of an idea, which is that this is not just a show about, you know, science or a weapon. It's about the life that grew up alongside it. You know, it really, it sort of transported us. And so we're very proud of the team at Imaginary Forces. I think it's a very well-deserved award. With steep competition,
no,
way, I should say.
Yeah, the title competition is always very competitive. There's always a lot of great work that's up for it. Ever since it started back in like the late 70s, early 80s, with some wonderful title people like Wayne Fitzgerald and Phil Norman, you know, some of the giants, Sal Bass, some of the great giants of, you know, of the art of making titles. And Imaginary Forces has always been there in terms of the quality of their work. I remember they did, one of the early things I saw them do was a wonderful TNT miniseries called George Wallace, with Gary Sinise playing that tremendous role, which he won the Emmy Award for, directed brilliantly by John Frankenheimer, one of the best miniseries I have ever seen, one of TNT's greatest productions ever. And they did the opening title for that, and again, another very striking title that told you everything you need to know, whether or not you knew George Wallace, of the times that he was around and shaped in one way or another, just tremendous. And speaking of times, we are in this time of scripted, incredible scripted television. It's bountiful. It's all over the place. So many networks doing it, plus Netflix, plus Hulu. Now that you've been a year in this marketplace, what do you think of it?
Well, look, I think it's an extraordinary time in TV. And I have the same experience that I'm sure you have and a lot of your listeners have, which is that I don't think my the dance card on my DVR has ever been more full. I think that's a great thing. It's really exciting to me as a creator of TV because, in a way, you know, I'm a viewer who's moved to emulation. I'm inspired by the work that a lot of colleagues in this business are doing right now. And most of all, what is really exciting to me is that I think that sort of this idea of the TV as the idiot box or the vast wasteland or this idea that successful storytelling and television has to condescend to its audience, I think that's sort of that's been exploded. There's some extraordinarily sophisticated and intricate storytelling that's happening in long form on television. And look, of course, it poses challenges from a business perspective. You know, it's harder to break through and it's harder to find an audience. But, you know, I fundamentally believe that audiences discover quality eventually, and it's been very, very gratifying to all of us that the show has had the response it's had.
And you use intricate. You could also say it's becoming more cinematic. There are techniques that are being tried in terms of both cinematography and film editing and syntax. You look at shows like American Crime on ABC. You look at what Vince Gilligan did with Better Call Saul, the first 7 minutes had no dialogue. It was music. It was black and white and color. It seems that everybody is now taking more and more creative chances. And the networks or whoever do the show say, okay, we'll back you up. You know, don't worry about it. And I wonder how that frees you as a series creator, as well as your writing team, as well as Thomas, the director, Thomas Schlamm, and so forth, in terms of, let's try this. Let's try that. Let's not worry about how the audience is going to react. We trust them.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, one thing for us making this show, we don't have a formula. You know, we don't have an obvious franchise for our show. You know, there's not a crime to be solved every week. To a certain extent, we have to sort of invent it, which is scary because you start from scratch in a way with every new episode. You know, we sort of see every episode as its own story, its own little movie, you know, and the 10-episode season we've made this year really is its own 10-hour movie with three acts. But, you know, look, I think it's tremendously exciting. And formally for us, there are some things that we have done in making this show that I think are incredibly daring and took a great deal of faith, and there might have been some white-knuckled moments on the part of our financiers. And part of it is because of the grueling schedules, for the most part, you know, TV shows are made on sound stages. You can control the lighting. You can control the climate. It is a very efficient way of turning out a product. From the very beginning, this great insight of Tommy Schlamme's was that this wasn't a show that could ever live on a soundstage. Really, the only way that we could make it and give it the life and the breadth that it needed, you know, this story, it is set on this sort of, you look at the landscape of New Mexico, and you're sort of somewhere between like a spaghetti western and, you know, Forbidden Planet or something. There's a kind of otherworldly quality, and that's the heart of this story of these physicists who moved to this far-flung and austere place and built this weapon. And so from the beginning, you know, Tommy's vision was we should do exactly what the Army did, which is build a town and not shoot it on stages. We'll shoot it in real buildings with four walls and windows and dust that blows in the windows and cars that drive by. And when you open the drawers, you know, they're full. The world is actually a sort of three-dimensional real world that we've created. You know, it's sort of like Bonanza or Gilligan's Island. That is an unusual way to make a TV show. And I think you feel it when you watch the show, that there is a kind of grit and there's a kind of fineness to the detail work. And I think it's I think you see it in the performances, too, because our actors, you know, when you yell cut, they don't sort of step off stage into a trailer. They're sort of living in a real world of 1944 New Mexico. You know, that in its own way is, I think, a quietly revolutionary thing that that has really made a difference for us in making this show.
And I've seen the episodes. They're very well photographed, and they're very earthy. You really get earth tones a lot because of the outdoor scenery and the Southwest in there in a very exciting way. Before I let you go, Sam, are there any issues either from that time or our current time that you didn't deal with in the first season that you will deal with in the second season? Whether it's issues of class, issues of race, issues of how people treat each other?
Absolutely. I mean, look, we sort of began to engage with some issues of gender and race and what the issues were for, you know, there's a huge population of Jewish physicists in this place in a moment in time, you know, historically when anti-Semitism ran rampant. And that was sort of an aspect of our storytelling in the first season, and it continues to be. I think the biggest thing that I would say is that more and more over the course of this second season, I think viewers will feel a kind of uncanny resonance between this story about a wholly different war in a wholly different decade, about World War II, and some contemporary events. It's a sort of a conversation about how much freedom we're prepared to throw away, you know, in order to feel safe and secure in the world, and about what the ethics of waging war overseas are, and the use of force overseas, and how we engage with weapons of mass destruction. I mean, that was all part of our storytelling in the first season, but the realities of those kind of impossible moral questions become much more emotionally real to the characters in this second season, and it made the storytelling very, very exciting to us. And, you know, I think it's a conversation that we really desperately need to be having as a country. So it's a privilege to be able to explore that while telling a story that we also think is just an exciting story to tell.
And you can join in the privilege tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central for the next episode of Manhattan on WGN America. Check your local for where that network is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about the program and the network itself, here's where you go online, www.wgnamerica.com. That's www.wgnamerica.com. And here in New York, there'll be a special presentation of the second season of Manhattan tonight as part of the opening festivities of the New York Television Festival, now in its second decade. If you want more details about the festival and the possibility of still being able to attend it here in the New York area, here's where you go online, www.nytvf.com. That's www.nytvf.com. The festival runs through Saturday night, and we hope to have some of the winners of the festival on an upcoming episode of our program. Sam Shaw, the creator, executive producer of Manhattan, again, congratulations on a great first season and on the Emmy Award. Have a fantastic second one and a great time tonight, and hopefully many, many more seasons to come. It's been a pleasure having you back.
Thank you, Simon. It's great talking to you again. Take care.
Same here. All the greatest. Take care. Have a fantastic time tonight.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Sam Shaw, the creator and executive producer of Manhattan, joining us here in New York. When we come back, our Crafted Tribute Question of the Week, and then the current and future state of diversity on television. We'll talk to one of the leaders charging the field, NAMIC President Elon Simons. He joins me here in the Big Apple after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You are listening to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com. More than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for sitting around talking movies. Catch Neil Rosen and Bill McCutty. They will sit around talk movies to you every week right here on Blog Talk Radio. And you can also check them out on the weekends on Talking Pictures On Demand. It's available here in New York on New York One and around the country on Time Warner cable systems all over the place. For more details, check online and check out Talking Pictures On Demand, as well as sit around talking movies every week right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, that's BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the second half of Tomorrow We Talk Live for this Monday afternoon of October 2015. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New York. Delight to have you with us. Another great guest coming your way shortly. And if you have a question or comment for that person, give us a ring, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Get 669 and 679 already in the room. Before we get to Elon Simons of NAMIC, it's time for our classic trivia question of the week. And if you know the answer and get it in right away, you can win the wonderful book by Neil deGrasse Tyson, Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries, published by W.W. Norton. Neil's Star Talk series on National Geographic Channel begins a new season next week. And you can also get a D-Rick TV tote bag if you know the answer to this question. Remember the classic TV series, Peter Gunn? That's the series that Craig Stevens shot to fame as that private detective. Henry Mancini's wonderful music, created by Blake Edwards, who also produced the series. Well, Mr. Gunn had a favorite hangout. Our question, name it, and I'll give you a hint. It's a music club where his girlfriend, played by the wonderful Lola Albright, sang on a regular basis. Again, the question, name Peter Gunn's favorite hangout. If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Please enclose your name and your mailing address. First, we'll correct the answer before our next show Friday afternoon. You will win Death by Black Hole by Neil deGrasse Tyson and a V-Rick TV tote bag. And you can also tweet the answer through hashtag TWBT. That's hashtag TWBT. Remember, the Twitter options made available by the wonderful people at Hopscotch. The fine folks invite you to create your own social soundtrack. You can learn how online at www.hopscotch.com. And if you just missed the question, just tuned in, no problem. I'll post it tomorrow on my Facebook page and my own Twitter hashtag at UBC Simon TWBT. That's at UBC Simon TWBT. In the last year, since our guest was on this program, diversity on television has definitely taken a lot of leaps, with programs like Fresh Off the Boat, American Crime, Blackish, all the Shyamalan shows on ABC, as well as Dr. Ken, which just aired a few weeks ago, many other shows, plus the continuation of programs like Being Mary Jane on BET, and the success of Bounce TV, which is available on cable and broadcast through various means. Well, where's diversity going from here? We're going to bring back a guest that has a lot to say about it. He is the president of one of the key trade associations following diversity, NAMIC. We welcome back from New York, President Elon Simons. Elon, great to have you again.
Nice being here, Simon. How are you?
Very, very well, thank you. Of all the developments that took place since you were last on this program last September, what do you think was the most important? Was it Shonda Rhimes becoming the first person of color to program an item of television, broadcast, or cable? Was it shows like Blackish? Was it American Crime? What do you think were the key developments that stand out to you?
Well, actually, it's sort of difficult to separate between them because they all impact diversity on the screen. To say that one is more important than the other would be difficult. You know, one person might say that the programs from Shondaland are particularly different in terms of content, and not everyone might necessarily like them. Or you think about Blackish, and that's giving a very positive picture of a family. When I think about Blackish, it actually reminds me of Cosby, quite frankly, which was a bunch of time ago. So which is the most important? From the impact of behind the screen's importance, I'd say the Shonda piece, the Shonda Rhimes piece, because it's more important in a lot of cases in terms of what's behind the screen and what's putting something together as opposed to the people on the screen. They both go together, but I think impact behind the screen is very important. So if you want to separate the elements, that's where I would go.
It's very clear, Egon, that diversity on television is a situation that you don't attack just one way. You have to deal with it on a lot of different levels in a lot of different places, whether it's individual shows, individual networks, the TV industry as a whole, the corporate suite at production companies and programmers, and so on down the line. What do you think is the next, or what are the next levels that you believe and Namath believe should be addressed to expand diversity from where it is now?
I would think that that would be behind the screen. The fact that there are opportunities for writers, for producers, for directors, that the whole gamut of talent that make up getting a program or show on the air. Certainly when you look at the actors, you'll see a repetition of the same actors over and over in some cases, and that's not a bad thing, but I think that the impact of people of color and minorities in all aspects of the business becomes so important. I think a lot of your consumer packaged goods and many other companies have learned the fact that having diversity behind the product, the development of the product, is very, very good because you then get the many different perspectives which are not always so obvious. Some things are going to be very unique. And I think the only way you guarantee or at least enhance the ability to have a wider perspective is to have it at all levels. If you're only looking from one set of lens, you're only going to see one part of the picture.
Mm-hmm. Your association had a remarkable conference during Diversity Week last month, and it was remarkable because of some of the keynote. You're welcome. And part of the remarkability came from some of the keynote people you had: Spike Lee, Eddie Huang, the inspiration for Fresh Off the Boat on ABC, who was very candid about his thoughts about the way the show is going there, and also Cynthia Lopez, the outgoing commissioner of New York's office, the mayor's office of media and entertainment. Of all the people that were there, who were you most impressed by, or who were your constituents most impressed by in terms of what they had to say?
That's a difficult one. I'm going to put Norman Lear and Spike Lee at par. I'll tell you why. It's interesting that Norman Lear, 93 years old, was able to reflect upon the decisions that he needed to make and what he wanted to do close to 50 years ago. I think he used the term, "I want to tell stories or depict television what life is really all about." Okay, and just think about it, as simple as that description is, how very, very real it is. And in that case, it was a perspective of families. I won't call it. It wasn't a racist thing as it is. That's what life is in Brooklyn or in Queens, I think it was, in terms of the neighborhood. I then go to Spike Lee, and basically he was saying the same thing. I want to tell stories about what is reality. In this case, it was a very, very testy subject that's in our headlines, in the political headline, and it's something that's rampant in one particular city. Now, the other two connect together in another way. Norman Lear said he had to take some tapes and put them back in the garage. Spike Lee said, from his perspective, only one person stepped up. So you think about a 50-year difference or 40-year difference between two very, very similar experiences in terms of an opportunity to tell a story. That's the key thing. So I don't want to separate Spike in his milieu, in his timing, and compare it with what Norman Lear did back then. But I think there were two very, very similar stories, two stories that have shown in one form or another success.
In both cases, it was one organization that stepped up to the plate. It was CBS that had the guts to put All in the Family on at the time that it did, back in 1971. And it was Amazon that now has the fortitude to put on Spike Lee's latest original film, Chirac, which is about the ongoing gang violence in Chicago, which to me is still the most underreported story nationally, and a tragedy that is in many ways going under our noses, But and there was an extended clip of the film that was presented at your conference. That was incredibly striking. It will. It's Spike Lee, I think, at his most magnificent, if you know the way he makes films. Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, was not happy that it was shot in Chicago. He's probably not going to be happy when the film comes out in December. And it's released simultaneously on Amazon, on smart TV sets, and in theaters. And I'm curious, you know, from your standpoint, you know, about those similarities, that that it's a case of, like, one organization and one filmmaker, one TV maker is willing to take the chances and find themselves in a partnership to do that.
Well, you know, it you used the term, it took one. It took one to in the case of Amazon, one in the case of Norman Lear. The thought process should be not that one person is willing or has the guts to step forward. It should be something that every person thinks about all the time. It's like saying that there is no racism in the South. It's like saying that schools, well, they're not really segregated. It's just the policy in the South. It takes someone with the guts and the bravado and the common sense to step forward and really depict what life is all about. Not so much being too careful about the politics, too careful about who's not going to like it, but think about what the creativity should be directed towards, which is telling a true story and letting people know what's going on. With the new outlets that are out there, it's not going to be just a few powerful people making that decision. The more outlets that are out there allows for more variety and more other opportunities for people to hear those stories. We should not depend upon a handful of people or a handful of executives making decisions on the whole rest of the country. It takes some guts to do that. It should be part of the mindset of everybody.
The Future Course of Diversity on Television, that's the subject of this half hour on Tomorrow We Tell Live, and we're talking to one of the champions for that. He's Elon Simons, the president of NAMIC. It is the TV trade association out to promote and expand diversity all over the place. And he's with us live in New York this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon Appleman, I'm live from New York with you on Blog Talk Radio. Happy you are with us on this Monday afternoon of October 2015. If a question come for Elon, don't be shy. Get that call going at 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Number is good anyway. You'll catch us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio. Also, get into our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Two ways to get your voice heard, because what you say matters. Coming up Friday on our program, John Gingemi. He's the co-creator and executive producer of Amazon's critically acclaimed new series, Red Oaks, with Steven Soderbergh among the other executive producers. And next Monday on Tomorrow We Tell Live, we go live to Cape Town, South Africa, and we will talk with the executive producer of Expresso. It is South Africa's most popular morning show, and now it is getting a same-day airing here in the United States through the Africa Channel. Bradley Vandenberg, producer of Espresso, live with us from South Africa. That's next Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. One of the ongoing issues with diversity, Elon, is that when you read every annual study by the Producers Guild of America, the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild, whatever the guild is, it always seems to be the same. 17% or so of all episodic television, even with the expanded episodic range we have now, is directed by or written or produced by women. 10 to 13% by people of color, 1% at best maybe by women of color. And you had a panel at Diversity Week that focused on specifically women of color. From what you gathered from the panel, which was very well received, what do you think needs to be done? What steps can be taken to expand the ability of women to write, produce, and direct programming?
Well, unfortunately, because I was running around, I didn't happen to see that panel. I heard it was a great panel. Just looking at the topic at large, I think the point becomes that if I'm a businessman and I want to make sure I see content crossing my desk and opportunities crossing my desk, I tell to the people who are further down the line, make sure that on your checkoff list you have women of color, women from Asia, whatever the criteria are. This way, those people make it a point of their responsibility to make sure they do see a diverse group of content providers, talent out there. The same way we put together a panel that talks about that particular issue, I think the fact that, the women in those groups and the networks in those groups should get together to make sure that they are also looking at all those opportunities. There should be a simple line that says, we're looking. It's like a casting call, and I'm clearly not from the film industry. In that casting call, you're looking for certain characters and certain talent. So I think they should have a casting call that makes sure that all types of producers, directors, and storytellers are on that casting call. That's maybe one vehicle, and you know, you've got to force the issue to make it happen so that it doesn't become an issue anymore. It becomes a natural occurrence.
To sort of expand that somewhat, Eglon, there is also the issue of how do we get people of color fully involved in the new opportunities in television, like smart TV apps, like apps for smart TV making devices like Roku and Google Chromecast, and very soon the Apple TV 2.0 and Shield from NVIDIA, and so on and so forth. We know there are people out there who want to create TV content and technology startups. And we talked about this last time you were here. We still have this economic ecosystem of venture capital and angel investment and incubators like 500 startups and accelerators that, while they have done a magnificent job in terms of funding the internet, including websites aimed at or owned by people of color, whether it is smartphone apps or tablet apps the same way, there is still this taboo of television. We don't fund this. And I wonder if that is a topic that your group is going to get more involved with. You know about Silicon Harlem, which their annual conference took place this past Friday. Clayton Banks, who was a former president of NAMIC, was on our show last year. They're really trying to get a community of startups together, TV included, that can get that funding. Do you think that that's something that NAMIC could get more involved with to sort of convince the VCs and the angels, hey, we have all these TV opportunities here, and people of color, women of color, should be at the center of them?
Well, the answer to in the broad sense of the question is a yes. The question is how we can do that. It's certainly not one thing that NAMIC can do by itself. It's a matter of finding the right vehicle, the right communications vehicle, and also to show the economics of why that is good business. Okay, I guess if somebody had said that I want to produce a show, Empire, and that's a mixture from the writing, from the producing, and everything else, and it's going to give some, we need some capital on it, they'd probably say no. So we need to, I guess, pull together the right set of statistics that's going to appeal to the VC people. You know, they don't really care. They only want to make some money. So we have to come together with that data that shows you can make money doing these things and be willing to take a risk on these things the way they take risks on everything else. So maybe there's some homework that we need to do on our part to make sure we do the right presentations to provide the right data. I think those companies that have been successful, and I think Diversity Inc. has talked about it and other vehicles have talked about it, that deal with diversity, seem to be a little bit more profitable and seem to do better. So if we need to use those statistics as a background, then it'll work. It's certainly something that NAMIC would be interested in, should play a part in, but it's not just as simple as getting up on a soapbox and talking about it. I think it's putting together the right data to show to these people who are not your normal audience what it might be for them as far as profit is concerned. And on the other hand, it might be something they want to do because they're good citizens, too.
Yeah. Eglon, one of the other guests you had on was Cynthia Lopez, who is the outgoing commissioner of the Mayor's Office on Media and Entertainment. Luis Castro is now the acting commissioner. He will be speaking later this week at another event going on along with the New York Television Festival, that's NYC Television Week, which starts tomorrow at the Waldorf Astoria, moves to the Omni Central Hotel in Manhattan on Wednesday and Thursday. And one of the things that I suggest, I'll put my two cents in, is that the Mayor's Office should take an advocacy role in arguing for VC angel money, et cetera, for new television startups, both content and technology. It seems that they're the natural organization to do it. And one of the another issue in this issue of getting this economic ecosystem to spend on television is that you don't get a sense that Mayor de Blasio or anybody of authority in city government, whether it is the New York Economic Development Corp, on the state level, Governor Cuomo, or Startup New York, seems to want to or seems to be inclined or appears not to be inclined to get involved in this issue. Any thoughts by naming perhaps working with the mayor's office to develop such an advocacy program or develop more of a at least a relationship where maybe you could do some joint projects?
No, I think that's a great idea, Simon. And I don't have an answer right now. What I'm reminded about is what Spike Lee said with the truck drivers in Chicago. I guess if we can make a connection to tie one to the other, it might be a place to start. You know, people that work on films and television production don't all have to be producers or writers or just need creative talent. So the answer to the question, yes, it would be great to do something like that. We can explore ideas. I appreciate the fact that Commissioner Lopez joined us. I think that's a step in the right direction. Here we are in her city, in our city, talking about all of diversity and all of the largest cable companies in the world in one place. Suddenly, it should be a quid pro quo. So, yeah, we'd be interested, and we can reach out to the deputy commissioner and see what can be done. I certainly want to make sure that New York is a part of any one of our conferences because we're sitting right there in Broadway, right in Times Square, and it should reflect where we are.
Mm-hmm. Ingrid Simon, the President Namick, with us a few more minutes here on Tomorrow We Tell Live. If you have a question or comment, get it in, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Where do you want to take Namick in the next year or so?
Namick grew, was formed, 35 years ago, basically concentrating on the cable business. And right now, our challenge is to make sure that we reflect the way our business has changed. Certainly when I joined at Cablevision 26 years ago, even in New York City with the New York Interconnect, there were over 12 different MSOs. Now that number is probably coming down to 2. And in between there, a lot of our supporting companies have branched out in terms of television, in terms of networks, the cable networks, in terms of the telephony business, in terms of the internet business. My whole dream is to make sure that Namick as an organization reflects everything that our industry has morphed into. And that is looking from the telephony side, looking from the internet side, looking from the Wi-Fi side, not just the creative side in terms of television and cable programming. When we reflect the full breadth of our industry, then I think we have continued our mandate representing people of color in this business. It's not just what comes on the screen. It's every aspect of our business. If we stay in one corner of it, then we're not going to be reflecting what the entertainment and the information part of our business is all about.
If you want to know more about Namick and the wonderful work that it does to expand diversity and television, both content and technology, here we go online, www.namick.com. That's www.namick.com. There are chapters all over the country, and those chapters also have their own websites. So you can check Yahoo or Google and search out those sites and what they do. And their chapters have various events that take place throughout the year. Ingrid Simon, the President of Namick, thank you again for joining us. A pleasure. And let's hope for more diversity in television. And we would love to have you back anytime.
My pleasure, Simon.
You're very welcome. Again, congratulations on the Diversity Week Conference. It was outstanding.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Ingrid. Take care.
Goodbye.
Ingrid Simon, the President of Namick, joining me here in New York. Thanks to him. Thanks to Sam Shaw of Manhattan for a wonderful hour. Thanks to all of you for listening. Coming Friday on Tomorrow We Tell Live, one of the co-creators and executive producers of Amazon's critically acclaimed new drama, Red Oaks, John Jangemi, one of the other executive producers, Steven Soderbergh. And next Monday, we will go live to Cape Town, South Africa, and we'll speak with the producer of their most popular morning show, Espresso, now available in the United States, every morning on a same-day basis, via the Africa Channel. Bradley Vandenberg joins us live from SA next Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Tamavi Televised. If you came in on the episode late, or you want to catch up on episodes you missed, we make it easy. Go to our homepage, www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. Our episode on Friday, by the way, has already had over 65 replays, and we thank you all for that, featuring folks from the new Spike TV series, Sweat Inc., with Julie Michaels, that premieres tomorrow night, GSN Television, that premieres on Wednesday night, and also Belief, which continues its 7-night miniseries tonight at 8 p.m. on the Oprah Winfrey Network. You can catch all of that and much more at www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. You can also hear our podcast at iTunes.com. Download it in your smartphone tablet. Take us on the go anytime you travel. And don't forget our simulcast replays available at www.youtube.com/BRICKTV. Also available at video.com and at www.ubctvnetwork.com. Thank you, as always, for tuning us in, and we'd like to hear from you. So email me, SimonApple04@yahoo.com. It's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. I return all my emails in 24 hours. These include your name and where you're from. You also find me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at UBCSimonTWBT. That's at UBCSimonTWBT. We love hearing from you because guess what? What you say matters. Absolutely. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants, not necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associates are Amy Domenico and Candace Williams. Andy Taylor, Blog Talk Radio's general manager, the creator and chief executive of this whole enterprise, is Mr. Alan Levy. For Tomorrow We Televise, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful rest of your week. Back with you Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific. You know where? Blog Talk Radio. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.